It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, split-ticket voting has been declining for decades, but recent polling from Marquette University suggests it's a possibility in this year's races in Wisconsin for governor and U.S. Senate. We'll talk to a political scientist about what we know about split-ticket voters and why they've been disappearing. First, fentanyl overdoses and opioid addiction continue to be a major problem in the United States. Our next guest sees a possible positive sign for the future. Opioid use is down among teens over the last few years. But even if we make progress against fentanyl, we may be missing deeper problems, she says, that make drug epidemics possible in the first place. Whether we're talking about crack cocaine in the 1980s, heroin in the 90s, or meth or prescription drug abuse, the list goes on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has addiction been an issue in your community, in your own family, your own life? Are there bigger picture solutions you'd like to see us try in this country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maya Solovitz is a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times. Maya is also an author of multiple books about drugs, addiction, and recovery. Her most recent is Undoing Drugs, How Harm Reduction is Changing the Future of Drugs and Addiction. Maya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In a recent piece in the Times, you find common themes from different types of drug epidemics over the decades, and we'll spend a lot of time there. I want to start by asking you about fentanyl, though, as you compare it to past drug epidemic outbreaks. What is unique? What is different about fentanyl?
It's incredibly deadly. And we've never faced anything this deadly before. And my next piece for the Times actually is about how to do prevention in that environment when we've previously told kids things like marijuana is as dangerous as other drugs. We have to be honest about the actual danger here after crying wolf for a long time. And that makes it very hard for prevention messages to actually get through.
I wanted to ask you about prevention messages. Yeah, a lot of the, since I was a kid, X number of years ago, there's a straight up, don't do drugs, drugs are bad, and kind of a equality among drugs from marijuana on up. How does that harm the effort?
Well, basically, kids are gonna do dumb things. And often that includes experimenting with drugs. And when you tell them that marijuana is going to kill you, it's going to turn you into a, you know, absolutely crazy person, and then that doesn't happen, and they see that not happening to their friends and not happening to people that they know, they don't believe you. And so then when they're going to try something like some prescription pill that their friend hands them, they're not going to be scared because they're like, well, they lied to me about that. Why are they telling the truth here?
In your most recent piece, as I mentioned, you're seeing a shred of good news anyway with fentanyl and opioids. Numbers going down among teens. What are we seeing there? And why is that particularly good news?
Well, it's absolutely incredible. Down by 83%. And so, you know, I think this is since 2000 or 2001. So it's a steady decline. And it does mean that kids really are getting the message about this dangerousness, probably because so many of them know siblings, parents, friends themselves who have run into trouble with opioids. And they're like, you know what, I'm not messing with that. And this is a thing we often see as drug trends change over time.
In this recent piece, the heart of it is saying, okay, yeah, we are currently at war with fentanyl or meth or crack or whatever the era is, but are there common themes that we can tackle, that we can find solutions in that prevent whatever the next drug is going to be? Where do we start?
So absolutely. There are three main commonalities between the vast majority of people who become addicted to anything. And these include having a predisposition to mental illness, which often shows up as an outlying temperament as a child. So you might be very bold or very shy or very anxious or very sad. Any of these extremes can be a predisposition to something. And a predisposition is not predestination, but what often turns a predisposition into an actual problem is the experience of extreme stress or trauma. And so most people with addiction have either a predisposition by itself that for whatever reason becomes an actual problem like depression, or they have a history of childhood trauma that could be anything from abuse to like losing a parent to natural disasters to all of the horrible things that can happen to anybody. So those are two of the three. And the third thing is a sense of despair and hopelessness, often just a sense that there's no future. And so most people with addiction have at least two of those and often all three.
So in a situation where, say, we stop the supply of crack cocaine and that had been the drug of choice that was going to find its way to that person, it sounds like that person in the next generation or the next couple of years might just find a different drug to be addicted on. Their predisposition doesn't really matter in some ways.
Yeah, it's not that specific. Most people with actual addictions are what they call polydrug users, which just means that they use multiple drugs. And so most people, by the time they get to an opioid, have already used cocaine or amphetamine, certainly marijuana and alcohol. And so what we see is basically people are unhappy, their lives are not going so great, and they're looking for a way to feel better. And that's really what drives addiction much more than the specific substance. Now, of course, some substances are more addictive than others, and certainly some are more dangerous than others. And some people will prefer a stimulant and some people will prefer a depressant. But basically, most people aren't looking to go up or down necessarily. They just want to get out.
We're talking to Maya Solovitz, author of a number of books about drugs and addiction. Her most recent is called Undoing Drugs. We're looking at some of the baseline causes of drug epidemics in this country and what solutions it could point us toward. What do you think of what you're hearing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have dealt or deal with addiction in your own life, someone in your family, your community, or if you're a treatment provider, are you seeing the kind of things our guest is talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maya, if we have this vulnerable population to, again, whatever the next drug of choice might be, what do we do with that? How do we use that information to help prevent the next drug epidemic?
Well, we can actually tell the people who are at risk for both addiction or mental illness or both of them, often as toddlers, because they stand out. They're different from the other kids on a number of different dimensions, like shyness, anxiety, boldness, sensation seeking, all kinds of different ways that people can stand out. And when you stand out, you often get bullied, and that often leads you to, you know, if it's a stress. We know the kids that are especially vulnerable. And also another vulnerability is your genetic history, which may then be exacerbated by growing up in a family with active addiction or mental illness, or both. So we know which kids are vulnerable, and we also know that traumatized kids are vulnerable. So what we have to do, without labeling them and without saying you have this thing, so therefore you're definitely going to get it, we have to teach them how to live with whatever they are coping with and how to manage it and how to be resilient to it. And there are many ways that we can do this. One of the most obvious is not traumatizing children in the first place. There's many things we can do. For example, you can look at how, let's say a kid is prone to sort of hopelessness and they have a kind of sad temperament. Well, you can use cognitive behavioral techniques that work with depression before depression even develops. And since what happens often in both addiction and mental illness is that your brain kind of gets into a groove that it can't get out of, and the less deep you wear that groove, the easier it's going to be to recover. So if you get these cognitive techniques before you've spent 10 years hating yourself, it's a lot easier to get better than if you spent 10 years truly believing that you're a terrible person because of the way you feel.
We're talking to Maya Solovitz, author and contributing opinion writer at the New York Times, with us to talk about her most recent Times article, The Most Important Question About Addiction, looking at ways to get to the root causes of widespread addiction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in drug prevention or rehabilitation, or have you been through a drug prevention or rehab program yourself? What do you see working? What doesn't seem to work? Do you want to see wider efforts to tackle some of these root causes of addiction to help people who are vulnerable not get addicted in the first place? What experiences are you willing to share? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Maya Solovitz, author and writer at the New York Times, looking at her most recent Times article, The Most Important Question About Addiction. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on ways to prevent addiction long-term in the United States, your own experiences with treatment, whether providing it or receiving it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maya, before we bring on our callers, I want to get to another factor you write about in your article, maybe a contributor to despair and hopelessness. You write about the crack cocaine epidemic showing up in urban areas where manufacturing jobs had left. Opioid addiction in the Appalachian parts of the country with similar economic despair. How much of an economic issue is this?
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. Inequality has been driving overdose deaths and addiction for a very long time. And if you look at when our overdose epidemic actually started, it was not with OxyContin in 1995 or 1986. It was in 1980 when inequality began rising exponentially. And at that same time, overdose began rising exponentially. The thing is, we didn't really see the trend because first the overdose was involving cocaine and people in the inner city, and then it moved to Appalachia. And we just thought, you know, this is different. And obviously a large part of that has to do with racism. But the fact is that when people feel absolutely hopeless about their economic future and they're losing things that they have that give them their identity, like a good job, the rates of addiction and of overdose and of suicide will increase. And it's not immediate, but it happens over time. And so often, because it doesn't happen instantly, we don't see the connection.
Do we pay enough attention to, in a way, you're coming at this from a public health angle, and I think a lot of treatment is at the individual level, which is also important. Do you think that we need to take this wider public health lens?
Absolutely, because obviously individuals are affected and individuals need help. But what helps people recover? Community and connection and other people and having a sense of meaning and purpose. And all of those things are basically social factors. So if you want people to get better or to not get addicted in the first place, they need to have good jobs, a sense of connection with others, and a sense of meaning and purpose. And this is often why addiction treatment is so hard, because it's not like you can prescribe, go get a sense of meaning and purpose.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Neil is with us in La Crosse. Neil, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me on. And I have a comment and a question. You know, in my work as a psychiatrist and you know, coming across patients with addictions and mental health crises, what I've tended to notice is that if it's not in someone's neighborhood or not going on around them or in their community, I get the impression that a lot of people, it's like ignorance is bliss. Well, if it's not around me, that's great. That's all I care. But I'm curious if that's something, you know, the author has seen or come across this phenomenon. And what could we do to break that barrier and help people understand that, hey, this is something that's going to indirectly or directly impact you, and we should care about this.
Interesting, Neil. Maya, go ahead.
Absolutely. You know, people like to say that addiction is an equal opportunity offender, but it actually isn't. It kicks people who are already down, whether because they have mental illness or trauma or despair. So we have to look at these larger factors. And one of the reasons that we do get this denial, oh, it's not going to affect me, is because we have so racialized the way we treat this problem in this country. So we basically, you know, have these racist views, and we have targeted certain groups of people for enforcement. So therefore, if you're like white and middle class, you often think, well, oh, this is not going to affect me. That doesn't work so well when you either have mental illness or other sources of despair. And it doesn't work so well when the middle class is collapsing.
Thanks a lot for that call, Neil, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Maya Solovitz. She writes for the New York Times, author of a number of books on drugs and addiction, including her latest, Undoing Drugs, How Harm Reduction is Changing the Future of Drugs and Addiction. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions. Let's go to Janet now in Wanakee. Janet, hi.
Hi. Thanks for letting me talk to you guys. I have a grandson, actually two of them, born addicted to methadone. And part of what we are seeing with both of these kids, especially the younger one, who is 14 now and in high school, is that he can't attend, he can't participate, and he is sometimes quite disruptive. And I'm wondering what the what you have in so far as advice on how to communicate both with the schools and with doctors on what's going on.
Janet, thanks for the call. Best to your family and your grandkids. Maya, I don't know if you have any specific advice, but any thoughts based on what Janet described there?
Yes, absolutely. It's really important to recognize that babies cannot actually be born addicted. They can be born with physical dependence and have withdrawal symptoms, but addiction is compulsive drug use that continues despite negative consequences, and a baby cannot have that. Now, there can certainly be effects of the drugs on the brain, but viewing kids as being damaged by their birth circumstances can often become a self-fulfilling prophecy of badness for that child. And there were a lot of kids who grew up in the crack years who were told they were crack babies and they were going to have no future. And that often made them rebellious and inattentive, et cetera. Now, there's also genetic reasons why people who have opioid addiction may have children who have attention issues. So I would bring the focus to what is the specific problem this child is having right now, and not so much look at the labels or tell the school that they have the labels or anything like that, but bring attention and care to the child and what their strengths are, not just their weaknesses. Because when kids have inattention in particular, they often feel like total failures. And this can reinforce itself. And so in order to not feel like a failure, what are the kids good at? What do they like? What do they enjoy? Because often with attention issues, kids can focus great on the things they like, whether it's a video game or playing music or playing basketball or playing, you know, whatever sport they may be into. It really depends on the kid. And so finding the things that the child likes and does attend to and does do well at and working from there can help them be motivated and help them get the help they need. And I also think it's really important to have them evaluated for, you know, whatever issues they may have, because they might have ADHD and they might benefit from medication if that's what they have. They might have experienced trauma as a child because of the parent's addiction, and you want to help them cope with that. They may also have, you know, temperamental predispositions that come from, you know, whatever their genetics may be. So I think it's really important to focus on the strengths, know where the problems lie, and work with professionals whenever possible to minimize them. Also, minimize labeling, though sometimes if a kid knows, oh, I have this, it's not I'm bad and I'm wrong and I can't do anything. Sometimes that can be helpful. It will depend on the child.
Janet, thanks again, and best to your grandkids. Maya, in just our last couple minutes, you are excited about harm reduction, and many other people are. Can you talk about that mindset and how it can help deal with addiction?
Sure. So basically, the idea of harm reduction is that we should focus not so much on preventing people from getting high, but preventing them from getting hurt, which can sometimes happen from getting high. So if we're focusing on how harm is done to people, it's very hard to look away from our drug policy, which does enormous harm to children and to adults by, for example, putting their parents in prison. So working from the perspective of let's minimize harm rather than let's try to stop people seeking euphoria, we can do enormously better. And when you look at places that have adopted harm reduction policies, treatment works better, policy works better. It really helps destigmatize addiction because, like, when you criminalize something, the whole point of it is to stigmatize it so that people don't do it. But when you focus on, okay, not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you? And when you look at it from that perspective, not as these are evil hedonists we need to stomp down, you can then do enormously better and stop wasting the talent and energy and potential of people with addiction, because some of the same things that cause the addiction can actually later be strengths. For example, if you can persist despite negative consequences, you are more likely to succeed as a writer who gets rejected all the time, for example. So there, it isn't only a weakness, it can also be a strength when it is directed appropriately.
Maya, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Maya Solovitz, contributing opinion writer at the New York Times, author of multiple books about drug problems, addiction, and recovery. Her most recent book is Undoing Drugs, How Harm Reduction is Changing the Future of Drugs and Addiction. She joined us to talk about the underlying causes of drug epidemics in the United States. Coming up after the news, a lot of voters go straight down the party line on Election Day, but some don't, and it can be enough to make a difference in close states like Wisconsin. We'll look at split-ticket voting, when it happens, and the impact it can have, and you could join in with your own voting story. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll look at split-ticket voting when people share their ballot between Republicans and Democrats. First, in Wisconsin's race for governor, both candidates agree that more state funding needs to go to local police departments to address crime and public safety. But the style of their campaign's appeals on the issue couldn't be more different. Evan Casey reports.
You've likely seen the campaign ads by now. They're hard to miss.
We've witnessed a surge in crime, the theft, and shots fired.
Evers broke his promise. Now we're less safe than ever.
Tim Michaels will have our back.
And stand strong against violent crime.
In Wisconsin's gubernatorial race, Republican candidate Tim Michaels has blasted Democratic Governor Tony Evers for rising crime and said it would be one of his top priorities as governor. Evers has addressed the issue by pointing to spending increases he's made for local police departments across the state. No matter the candidate's approach, crime is one of the top issues that Wisconsin voters are focusing on this election. It's also a highly partisan issue. A Marquette University Law School poll found 74% of Republicans said they were concerned about crime, compared to just 38% of Democrats. Barry Burden is a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says Michael's campaign can benefit by attacking the incumbent on the issue.
As long as, you know, that is effective in reminding people about their concerns, maybe their fears about crime, it will maybe turn them against Governor Evers as they search for an alternative.
According to the State Department of Justice, violent crimes are up in recent years. Some national experts, and Evers himself, blame recent increases on the tumultuous pandemic years. But what can a governor do to address crime in a community? Kenneth Street is a law professor at UW-Madison. He says one method is a longer-term public health approach aimed at addressing the root causes of crime. Another approach? More state funding for local law enforcement.
If you were really going to have a vision as a governor, you'd say, I recognize that the local people have the best chance of understanding what kind of interventions could we do to turn it around
Evers has said if he wins the race, he'd propose shared revenue increases for local governments. That plan includes $10 million for first responders. He's already allocated millions in federal pandemic relief funds for local police. The majority of those grants went to Milwaukee, which has seen record numbers of homicides. Michaels has also committed to increasing state spending for local police, but he hasn't said how he'd pay for it. His Back the Blueprint plan calls for more police officers in, quote, dangerous neighborhoods across the state. That's encouraging to Andrew Wagner, the president of the Milwaukee Professional Police Association. That union endorsed Michaels for governor.
He doesn't want the status quo. He wants to increase that police force and make sure that the city has what they need to be safe.
But not everyone believes more cops is the answer. Angela Lang is the director of the Milwaukee-based community activist group Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC. She believes Michaels' approach is the wrong one.
Some of the things that he supported, it feels very heavy-handed. It's very much, even if you go to his website, it's very much Back the Blue. Whereas in contrast, we see Governor Evers kind of lead with a more compassionate approach.
She wants to see more investment in public education, housing, healthcare, and mental health resources. Those are things Evers invested in with pandemic funds.
Those are what's going to help thriving communities and hopefully reduce crime as well.
Issues of crime and policing can be extremely contentious. And nowhere is that clearer than in the campaign's discussion of Kenosha in 2020. After a police shooting there, the city erupted in protests and riots that turned deadly. Michaels and other prominent Republicans have made an effort to blame Evers for what they say was a lack of leadership during the crisis. Others support Evers' decision. Kyle Johnson is BLOC's political director. He lives in Kenosha, and he says Michaels is using the incident to score political points.
It's hogwash. I mean, I have stronger language that I could use, but I won't because you're on radio. But honestly, it's dishonest and it's hurting people. It's costing people their safety.
The candidates met for their only debate last Friday. Michael said if he was elected, there would be a, quote, new sheriff in town. On November 8th, the voters will decide for themselves. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, could Wisconsin see a rebound of split-ticket voting in this year's midterms? That's a possibility raised in a recent piece of political analysis in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It points to recent polling from Marquette University that shows Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson with a lead over his Democratic challenger. Same polls show Democratic Governor Tony Evers with a smaller lead over his Republican opponent. With partisanship on the rise, split-ticket voting has been declining for decades, but in a closely contested state like Wisconsin, a little bit can go a long way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you split your votes, picking and choosing? Republican here, Democrat there, or other in that other place? When is the last time you split your ticket in an election? Was it in the last election, 1980s, sometime in between? Or are you party line all the way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura Brown is a political scientist and author of Amateur Hour, Presidential Character and the Question of Leadership. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. It's great to be with you.
Now, you are particularly interested, I think, in states like Wisconsin with a statewide race for governor and a statewide race for U.S. Senate. Why is split ticket voting so much on your mind this time around?
Well, I think it's on my mind because there are these states like Wisconsin that are so close and they are so competitive in both races. And what we see is that there have been some differences in the polling. We also know that voters sometimes think about a senatorial race or a gubernatorial race differently. They say to themselves what issues are more likely to matter for a candidate who's going to Washington versus one who's staying home and looking after their state. So I think there are a lot of specifics and particulars with regard to this election. On the Democratic side, you can think about something like abortion that might push voters to actually vote Democratic at the state level, since that's now a decision at the state. But then, of course, the overall state of the economy, in the sense that that the Democrats and President Biden are not really caretaking the economy, and that inflation's a big issue, may be pushing some people to say, you know what, I want more Republicans in Washington. So I think there's a lot of cross pressures and a lot of specifics that could make a difference, even if it's just a small number of voters.
I think back to the 2018 election here in Wisconsin, where I was doing our election night coverage. At about 8 o'clock in 1 second, they called the race for Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat. She ended up winning by 11 points. Governor race, nail biter, Democrat Tony Evers wins by about 1%. Clearly, somebody was out there doing something other than going party line all the way.
Absolutely. I mean, I really do believe that there are voters who are both cross-pressured, and there are voters who really think about the candidate themselves. They aren't just focused on, say, the party line issues. They are trying to make the best choice with the best person. And even though it is a declining share of voters, and when we look to, you know, a couple of the races in 2020 where we saw this in New Hampshire and North Carolina, where opposite parties won each race, what you saw was that, for the most part, it was popular incumbents who won each race, even though they were of opposite parties. And it was also clear that somewhere between about 3 to 7% of the voters in those races must have split their tickets. So this is where, again, you know, every vote counts, and it really will matter how close these races are on election day.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi. I've been voting since Dwight Eisenhower. And it's kind of interesting that I split my ticket almost every time. And the reason I split my ticket is because I vote for the country. I don't vote for an individual. I think that's a democratic way to do things. I think it's, if you do your own research, there's no pressure on you because you know who you're voting for. And so if you're dumb enough to vote party line all the time, this is what you get. And I guess that's my comment.
Pat, thanks a lot. Now, I think there are more people unlike Pat these days, Lara, who are more prone to vote party line. But Pat, clearly a pick and choose candidate by candidate.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do believe that, you know, individual candidates matter. I mean, I wrote a book that is focused on presidential character for exactly that reason, that I do think that character says something about, you know, how that person is going to do the job, whether they have, you know, a Republican lean or a Democratic lean in terms of their issue positions, and they will be pressured by their parties. But I do think that it is not, and it should not be, kind of looked down upon by partisans for people to actually cast these sort of independent type votes.
When people analyze members of Congress, it seems like there's a trend where you have fewer, or basically no liberal Republicans, fewer moderate Republicans, no, or at least fewer conservative Democrats. Are the parties kind of sorting themselves out enough that may, in a way that might make split ticket voting less likely?
Well, the parties have certainly done that. We now see both Republicans and Democrats being much more ideologically and sort of consistent with their policies and their beliefs. So you have fewer, you know, kind of moderate or independent leaning partisans affiliated with either party. But what has resulted is a larger number of Americans saying that they self-identify as an independent because of it. So the share of each party's voters in the overall electorate is actually going down, and the number of Americans who say that they think of themselves as independents has gone up and sustained in the, you know, mid-40s for quite a while now. And I think this really speaks to the fact that partisans should be more concerned about voters who are thinking about issues and are thinking about candidates as not being altogether one thing.
We're talking to political scientist Laura Brown about split-ticket voting, when people vote for some R's, some D's, some G's or I's or L's too, maybe along the way on the ballot, and if that could change in this year's midterm elections. Call it at 800-642-1234. Do you vote for individual candidates? Do you pick some from different parties? When's the last time you did it, if it's been a while? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about split-ticket voting. When someone votes, say, for a Republican in this race, a Democrat in that one, author and political scientist Laura Brown stays with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you split your tickets when you vote? Did you used to, but you don't anymore? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Superior. Scott, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I used to split my votes. I consider myself more financially conservative, but socially more liberal. But with a lot of like the misinformation and type of campaigns out there, I've found myself more on the social voting block, so more Democratic. And so I was wondering, how do we address that misinformation campaign? Because it's, to me, it misconstrues a lot of what both parties are talking about.
Scott, thanks for the call. Laura, misinformation in the election, Scott says that swayed him to stop splitting.
Yeah, I mean, really, what a fantastic question. I mean, I do know that there are so many people who feel as though they can't get good information anymore, because part of it has to do with the fact that a lot of legitimate and worthwhile media is actually subscription-based. And a lot of the kind of conspiracy-minded, all about the clicks and the grift is free and available on our social media feeds. So I do think that there is this very real problem where people are believing many things that are not true. And it's because it's difficult, more difficult than you would think it should be, to get good information easily.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Appleton. Chris, hi.
Hi, thank you. You know, I used to split my ticket. I made it a point to split my ticket, but I stopped doing that after our state was so gerrymandered after 2010. I just don't want that much power in control, or that much power to one party. Thank you.
Chris, thanks for the call. Chris, disillusioned by our gerrymandering in the state, Laura.
Yeah, well, you know, what is so interesting, and this gets to this difference between a governor and a senator, but it's also true at the House level or the state legislature. You know, when you're voting for a senator, you're not just voting for Senate, you know, so to speak. You are actually voting for the majority in the U.S. Senate, right? Your senator will contribute to or make up either the majority coalition or the minority coalition in the Senate. Whereas when you vote for governor, that person is an executive, and so they are singular. And I do think that, you know, voters who think about splitting their tickets, voters who consider something other than a party line strategy, are also thinking about that. They are saying to themselves, do I want this party or that party to be in control in a legislative body? And that's different than, do I want the governor's mansion to be run by one party or another?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to political scientist Laura Brown about split-ticket voting, when people vote for different parties on the same ballot, maybe one in a race for governor, one in a race for Senate. Still time for you to join in with your questions, your practices, if you're willing to share that. When it comes to ticket splitting, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura, one thing I wonder about with legislatures, as you were just talking about, the idea of if someone's voting for majority control, there's this concept of party discipline. How well do members of a party hold together to vote for something? You know, occasionally we get, you know, a Joe Manchin holding up this piece of legislation, or John McCain as senator holding up overturning Obamacare at one point. How much is that party discipline has changed? How does that affect that decision to vote for this candidate based on your hopes for party control?
Well, I do think that's a big part of what's going on. What we see is that legislation nowadays is really built, I would argue, from kind of the extreme ends of each party's coalition inward, rather than starting from the center and then building outward as they used to. And this is something that's been going on from the 90s. And I do think that this party discipline has also made it more difficult for people to want to split their votes, because they say to themselves, look, even if I vote for this person who says they want to be independent, when they get there, they're not going to be able to. And I know that, so I better, you know, cast my ballot all one way. And I, again, I mean, it's a fascinating moment we're in, because in some ways what we are seeing is so much of what we saw in the Gilded Age, before we could even do ticket splitting, because the parties actually printed and counted the ballots.
You are interested in Wisconsin, of course. We have close elections, to where ticket splitting could mean that we have a senator from one party, a Democrat from another. What are some of the other big states that are on your radar where split tickets could really sway things one way or another?
Well, certainly, I think nationally, everyone is looking at Arizona and Pennsylvania. Those are states where we saw, you know, President Trump kind of weigh in with his favored candidates. And those candidates are not faring as well in the general election as they did in the primaries. And there is this sense that you could see kind of opposite results in these states, though Pennsylvania appears to be leaning toward both Democrats winning, but certainly Josh Shapiro, who's running for governor, is much more favored over Mastriano than Fetterman is over Oz. And then I think you look at Arizona, where you can see that the Carrie Lake and Katie Hobbs race for governor is much closer than the race for senator, where Mark Kelly is leading.
Now, part of all of these races will be decided by, you know, turnout. Democrats, do they show up? Republicans, do they show up? I want to talk about the independents. Sometimes I think in the media, I have the experience anyway of thinking, okay, well, there's Democrats, there's Republicans, and all these independents in between them in the middle. That's not really how it works, right? Like, we might have that socially liberal, fiscally conservative caller who agrees with one party on this, one on that. One might have a single issue that they're that's important to them. What do we know about the independent voter and how they make these decisions?
Well, we don't know enough. I mean, the truth of the matter is independent voters and moderates are people who really need a closer study from political science. There is something of a consensus in political science that these people may just not be as interested in politics. But some of the more recent findings are that it may be more accurate to say they just think about politics differently. And whether they are sort of completely moderate across all of their issues, or they have a mix of liberal and conservative issues, the general spectrum just doesn't suit them very well. And so this is where I would say, you know, the one thing that we do know is that these voters tend to make up their minds later in the process, so closer to Election Day. And it's often the reality that these voters do end up being decisive in who ends up winning the race. So I do think the parties should focus on them more. The candidates certainly should, and absolutely political scientists should as well.
Laura, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Laura Brown, political scientist and author of Amateur Hour, Presidential Character and the Question of Leadership. She is with us today to talk about the decline of split ticket voting and why it could still be a big deal in closely contested states like Wisconsin, with big races for governor and the U.S. Senate. If you have a history of voting split tickets? Still love to hear from you. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Do you do it all the time, or do you remember the last time you did it? If so, how long ago was it? You can email ideas@wpr.org and let us know. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the Biden administration is taking a moonshot approach to look for cures for different kinds of cancer. Kate talked to the White House administrator of that program on tomorrow's show, along with a Wisconsin cancer expert. And you can join the conversation. As always, call in with your experiences and your question for Kate's guests. You can email now, ideas@wpr.org. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. A couple weeks back, a guest on the show made the case that we should be more willing to do things that we are bad at. If you enjoy it, try it, do it. I was off that day, but I thought it was interesting, and I gave it a try this week. I had the house to myself for a while, so I tried playing piano and singing. And I'm not bad at playing the piano. I'm also not good at it. I'm mediocre. But when I start singing, my piano playing sounds pretty good by comparison. But I did it anyway. Figured out the chord progressions for a few songs, looked up the lyrics online, because I'm also bad at remembering lyrics, and I sang out loud at volume. There were no witnesses, and that's okay, because quality or not, I had a lot of fun. My set list included selections from Pink Floyd, Muse, and Sneaker Pimps. Here, I'll give you a sample of my singing. Oh, out of time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.